All right, so without a doubt, mindfulness is the new craze. People want to bring mindfulness into schools, work, and their own lives. And the research is clear. Taking just 10 to 20 minutes to meditate every day is hugely beneficial for our well-being and health. As someone who meditates daily, right, I can attest to it being helpful. But if I was honest with you, I haven't always felt the benefits. That is, until I learned to really bring mindfulness to everyday activities, everyday conversations, to everyday stressful life situations. Today's guest, Minna Blake, is going to share how we can bring embodied mindfulness into our day-to-day, minute-by-minute experience as a leader and bring it to our teams to help us overcome the obstacles that are keeping us from making the changes or taking the steps that we've been wanting to take for some time. If you didn't listen, I highly recommend going back and listening to part one. It'll help you to have a much better understanding of somatic intelligence. Welcome to the Coaching Culture Podcast, the podcast to help you grow as a leader and build a better culture. My name is JP Nurbin, and I'm joined by my friends and co-hosts, Nate Sanderson and Betsy Butterick. In addition to this podcast, I'm a leadership coach and culture consultant. To learn more about how my business, TOC, can support you and your team, visit tocculture.com. To learn more about Betsy and her work, go to betsybutterick.com. Also, don't forget to subscribe to the TOC newsletter. Every Thursday, you receive a short article, as well as the notes to each episode of the podcast, as well as our top 10 podcast episodes and my top 10 articles. Subscribe using the link in the description of this episode, or simply go over to tocculture.com and click on newsletter. Okay, so much of leadership, like good leadership, is around making good decisions, like effective decision making. And we could get caught up in a lot of, once again, tools and tricks to make better decisions and who to consult. And we can get up so caught up in the thinking. But you say in the book, your capacity to feel your sensations is inseparable from your ability to choose a wise course of action. So my question is, how does this embodiment, help us in choosing the right thing and making the right decision?
Yeah. So let me take a departure into research here. And it reminds me that I promised earlier to share some of the research about what are the effects of developing embodied self-awareness. And I forgot to do that. So we'll come back to it. Specifically around decision-making, there's been interesting research around what's called the somatic marker theory, which essentially surfaces the understanding that when we, the more sensitive we are to our somatic markers, in other words, to those little internal cues, is my spine straight or collapsed? Is my, right? And we don't need to be describing it to ourselves in words, although when we're beginners at it, it helps to do that, right? But if right now, as you're listening, you know, the two of you happen to be sitting, I think, or actually Betsy, you might be standing, right? But whatever part of you is making contact with the earth. So the floor, you might have feet on the floor. You might have a seat in the chair. If the listener is lying down, you know, you might be lying down. So just notice, like, some part of you is making contact with the earth or whatever's on the earth. That's just a somatic marker, right? And those little somatic knowings actually travel up into this and overlap with the parts of our brains that are involved in decision making. So studies have been done about folks that sort of comparing folks with healthy brains to folks with lesions in what's called the ventral medial prefrontal cortex, which is a part of our brain that is involved in both decision making. It's sort of the highly vaunted sort of right under your forehead, front part of your skull, right? Very important for decision making. That part of our brain also makes sense of our sensations. What are our sensations telling us? And what's been clear based in this research is that for folks who have damage to that part of their brain, they make objectively worse decisions. So for example, in a gambling task, where folks with healthy brains will start to slowly sort of make more advantageous gambling decisions, the folks with lesions in that part of the brain will not do so. in a decision about sort of comparing one apartment to another, folks with healthy brains will be able to see differences, and based on the parameters in the experiment, right, they'll choose sort of the preferable apartment based on those parameters. And the folks with lesions in this part of their decision-making and physical cueing part of their brain will make objectively worse decisions. So this is a part of our decision-making apparatus that we can't turn off. It's affecting us all the time anyway. These little somatic markers that, you know, right now we just experimented and went, where are you touching the earth, or where are you touching the chair or the floor or whatever. But they'll come up as like a little discomfort, right? But we're so subtle that we don't even really notice it. Or just, I feel like I'm kind of leaning in one direction. You see how this stuff kind of shows up in our language, right? We can't understand the world in any way but an embodied way. So it's very interesting to know that the anatomy for decision making overlaps with the anatomy for sorting out the meaning of sensations, and that that is switched on all the time. When we get more conscious about what our sensations are, we can start to factor that into our decision making in more kind of intelligent and skillful ways, as opposed to just having it drive the bus outside of consciousness, right? So that's decision making. Let me pause there, and then we can come back to sort of leadership outcomes of developing embodied self-awareness.
One thing that I was going to circle back on is in talking about the individual, which is fantastic, and I believe it starts there, and thinking about sports and teams. If a team felt disconnected, and let's say largely they don't have a somatic background or a strong somatic understanding, is there an activity or exercise you would do with them to help foster some of that connectedness in a shared space?
So with teams, okay, my sport, I was a synchronized swimmer. I was surprised, and then in the end, kind of not surprised, to learn that one of the things that helps people sync up together is something called synchrony. And we see it, for example, you'll see more right hemisphere coordination. So brain waves in the right hemisphere are more coordinated in musicians that are playing music together, right, on the same rhythm, than you might expect. So they will wind up with brain wave synchrony across, say, a musical quartet, right? And all from being in the same rhythm. You also see this with people marching together. So marching bands, unfortunately, this has also been used in military operations, right? But there is a whole series of studies around what's called moving together in time. And we have in our bodies oscillators, cells that tell us, for example, about circadian rhythm, or help us coordinate things like our blink rate or our breathing rate or our pulse rate. They're sort of cells that tell us about time. And when human beings move together in time, think about something like a drum circle, right? And how drum circles have been used throughout history in very sort of important ceremonial ways, right? Or to initiate a ritual inside of a community, or to call a community together, right? There's a form of Japanese drumming called taiko that's all about calling a community together. There's drumming in Native American communities that's about calling community together and sort of raising a community to some level of spiritual elevation. So these kinds of rhythmic moving together in time actually teach us to sync up. And in the book, I write about a workplace team that was, well, they were challenged by a number of things, but we used an exercise with them to help them move together in time, right? And had them move from different small groups So this group has worked out its rhythm, and this group has worked out its rhythm, group A and group B. And now you from group B, go integrate yourself into group A, right? And all of a sudden, everybody needs to kind of readjust, right? And this was something that for this company, they needed to do all the time. And there are some sports teams that need to play this way too, where it's like, and now we're throwing a new player in the game, you come out, right? And so how do you adjust? Well, that process of physically moving together in rhythm is really, really helpful for getting people in sync with one another. Now, it's not the only thing that you would need, because if you have, for example, interpersonal conflicts on the team, you also need to be able to have conversation about that and resolve those conflicts. But we can do that better when we have practiced ways of being in conflict, right? That can support better communication in those situations. Yes.
Yes. So do we want to hop to those leadership outcomes, or do you want me to take this somewhere else? Where do you want to go?
No, I was just going to say
research.
Let's talk about this, because I think it's really cool. So this is from my doctoral research, and this is results of three different studies. Some of it was interviews, talking to people. Excuse me. A good portion of it was surveying over 500 coaches, not sports coaches, but leadership, executive, and health coaches, some relationship coaches from around the world, about their experiences of embodied self-awareness and their experiences of some of the kinds of training that I'm describing here, right? Some of that kind of learning. And the upshot, what I think is really interesting, couple different things that I think are really interesting. So there were six major outcomes that we found, all of them landing at or above the average effect size in psychology, right? So the average effect size in psychology is pretty low. It's around, on average, 20%. You do X, you make a change, about a 20% change, right? Because we're very complex human beings, and a single intervention doesn't really do very much. So all of these results were really in the like 40 to 50% range, really very, very strong outcomes. And what we saw is, as you increase your embodied self-awareness, you'll have an impact on the following things. So for yourself, flourishing, which is a measure of satisfaction and well-being in life, resilience and adaptability. So can I handle change? Can I handle kind of difficult situations and bounce back from difficult situations? So flourishing, resilience, and adaptability. And then in relationships, empathy, conflict management, and connectedness. Again, all really strong results. Yeah. And it's great seeing your faces. So I think, go ahead, Betsy.
No, it's just all the things, you know, it's like, hey, how do you want your team to improve? It's like, well, Amanda's six outcomes.
How about these things? And so bottom line, embodied self-awareness is very, very powerful in developing these things. Now, we were specifically looking at the impact of embodied self-awareness on developing emotional and social intelligence competencies. So there's also a range of other things that you could look at. I gathered data on, this hasn't been published, so you'll hear about this, but this isn't vetted and peer reviewed. But for example, one of the other things that I was interested in studying is, what's the effect on non-dual awareness, or in other words, our understanding of ourselves as integrated and interconnected with all of life. And again, the effect sizes there were very, very high, on the order of 45 to 50%. So a lot of people say, when they do this work, and they start to kind of get into this, like, and you said it earlier, Betsy, you're like, this is like magic, right? And other people, if they have some spiritual interest or some religious background, they'll start to tie it to that. I've seen this over and over again. And I think it's because fundamentally a big part of what this approach offers is an experience of our interconnectedness with all things. And we experience that through sensation, the language of life. That is the original language of life. Before we had words, all biological organisms can sense themselves in space and experience themselves in some sort of sensory way. Even a single-celled organism will move towards food and cringe away from a sharp object, right? We all know how to approach and avoid based on sensation. So this is like the original language of life. And when we learn how to speak that language, we get a lot more connected to life. Our own life, I was saying, right? Like I'm more aligned with what's important to me. Others, we get, you know, better at empathy and connectedness and conflict resolution. Whole bunch of stuff to study around how we might get more connected to animals, plants, trees, the earth. What might this have to offer into our ecological crisis that we're in the midst of, right? So a lot of possibility here.
Mm. There's so much more I'd love to dive into the research, but I want to kind of shift away a little bit more to the practices, right? So yeah. what this looks like for leaders on a daily basis, some of the work they could be doing. One of the, I think growing in popularity is mindfulness, right? Some sort of mindfulness meditation practice. And I think you are touching on some benefits to that type of practice that maybe some people are unaware of. They're not tapping into as much as they could be. I'm wondering if you could speak to that, as well as one thing that you talk about pretty extensively in the book is exteroception, interoception, and proprioception. Hopefully I nailed all those terms right. I'm really bad with language. Just the difference between those. I think that's relevant a little bit to some of the work that you're doing around mindfulness practice with potentially with your clients and even yourself.
Cool. Yeah. So let me take each of those in turn. So in the book, I write about this model of embodied mindfulness in action. So this is a form of mindfulness, right? The definition of embodied self-awareness is present moment. I didn't come up with this. This is what's in the research literature already. It is present moment, non-judgmental attention to sensation, movement, and emotion. Sensation and movement being physical, emotion being effectively our evaluation of those physical sensations, right? We have a fluttering heart. Well, are we excited or are we anxious? That's the evaluation of the physical sensation. So present moment, non-judgmental, that's mindfulness, right? Present moment, non-judgmental attention, that's mindfulness. When I talk about embodied mindfulness in action, I'm talking specifically about embodied mindfulness, embodied self-awareness. So that present moment attention to sensation, motion or movement and emotion in relationship, in action, with your eyes open while you are walking around the world with others. So it's distinct from and supported by sitting quietly on a cushion with your eyes closed. And one of the reasons that we sometimes need to sit quietly on a cushion with our eyes closed is because we are neurobiologically tipped towards exteroception. So exteroception, that's our five senses. Eyes, ears, nose, mouth, and our sense of touch are all oriented to paying attention to what is happening outside our own skin, because we cannot put any of that on autopilot. And so those nerve cells, those exteroceptive nerve cells, are larger, louder, faster than our interoceptive nerve cells that tell us about our interior visceral experience, our interior sensation. That's why we often want to go to a quiet place or close our eyes or turn off all sort of noise and distraction in order to pay attention to what's happening inside. And the real higher level skill is, can you learn to pay attention to what's happening inside right now while you're listening to me with your eyes open, right? And if you can learn to do that while listening to a podcast, can you learn to do that while you're talking to your teammates or while you're talking to your athletes, right? And if you can learn to do that in an ordinary conversation, can you learn to do that when you're in a knockdown, drag-out fight, right? This is why conflict management is one of the important outcomes of developing embodied self-awareness. So as you get better and better at embodied mindfulness in action, you get more access to those interoceptive, visceral sensations that are coming from heart, gut, lungs, your fascia, all parts of your body that are like your five senses. They are sensory, and they are giving you important information about yourself and the world that you live in. But we are biologically tipped to put that information on autopilot. And because of that, that information never switches off. It's always coming up into our brain, but it's kind of driving the bus behind the scenes, right? It will affect us without our conscious awareness. So unless and until we pay attention, we will miss those signals, we'll miss those cues. And then the third that you mentioned, JP, proprioception, that's the ability to know where our body is in space. This is the capacity for a gymnast to do a backflip on a high beam. It's also the capacity to get a basket into the hoop, right? It is the capacity to put your body where you intend it to put it. And as athletes, we get really good at that. But we tend to not know, not due to any fault of our own, we just aren't taught this in our culture. We tend to not know, like, oh, when I am in a challenging spot, what I tend to do is clench my teeth. Or when I'm in a challenging spot, what I tend to do is tap my foot on the floor. We might know that because sometimes when we're in a challenging spot, we catch ourselves doing that thing, or somebody has told us, like, oh my God, you're making that face. Why are you making that face again, right? So we'll get feedback from the world about what our habits are. So proprioception kind of, you know, if interoception's a little hidden and exteroception's always on the surface, proprioception, the position of our body in space, including our gestures, our facial expressions, that's a little bit in between, sometimes a little bit conscious, sometimes a little bit less so. So the more we develop discernment around, like, awareness of and discernment around our interoceptive and proprioceptive experience of life, our embodied experience of life, we get smarter about the stuff that matters the most to us.
And I think what you just shared there, it really took me a long time to figure that out. And I was so glad when I finally did. I think I've been meditating probably fairly regularly for about 7 years now. Mm-hmm. But the first probably 3-4 years is like, okay, do it. And then I just expect benefits to come. You know, I think I'll be happier and more calm. And it was only then I realized in the last, you know, 3 years or so that this mindfulness in action, it's just, like you said, there's a connection. It's helping to prepare me to be more mindful in conversations, in strenuous moments where I'm trying to deal with 2 or 3 fighting kids, you know, screaming and doing the dishes, or I'm with a team and I'm with athletes, or I'm stepping on stage to speak to people, or I'm hopping on a podcast to interview a famous author, right? So whatever it be, like, it's that connection, I think, is so, so important. I think that's what a lot of people miss when they talk about meditation and mindfulness, is they don't understand how the mindfulness and action piece, how it's all really preparing for that, right?
Yeah. Yes. And what I want to emphasize, without in any way knocking the value of mindfulness, it's incredibly valuable and a huge support to what we're talking about here. So if you do that and you love it, keep doing it. In fact, I'll say a couple, maybe we'll return to some of the research on that. But what I want to say is, like, many times in life, a situation calls for more calm, right? You've got 3 screaming kids and you're trying to do the dishes and you're like, ah, my hair's on fire. I think maybe if I could just find a little center, find a little ground, find a little breath in this moment, I could maybe respond a little better. Okay, true. And there are moments where we are tested by life where calm isn't actually what's needed. What's needed is a forceful response. What's needed is a really strong backbone. What's needed is maybe not a raised voice, but a very clear voice, right? So there are instances in life where that doesn't mean that you're not calm in those situations, but you may need to be additionally energized right? You may need to bring yourself to a situation with a lot of energy and commitment and kind of moral fortitude, right? And those instances test us just as much, right? So it's not always about calming down, slowing down. Sometimes it's about increasing our energy. Even if we're increasing our energy in a way that's like not frantic and frazzled, it might be a calm way to increase our energy, but it's not always like a dampening.
Yeah, I want to be mindful of your time. And so we just got one or two questions here left. And one of these is I want to throw kind of a little bit of a case study your way.
Sure.
That let's just say a coach hires you and says, hey, Amanda, I really have a team that struggles to be honest with each other, to give each other feedback. Like we're great off the court or off the field. We love each other, but we don't give hard conversations. You know, we don't get those. We can't take that step. You know, how might taking a bit of a somatic approach and doing some of the work, how might you approach a group like that? What might be one of the tactics or you know, that you bring to that team?
I just have to tell a funny story. So I write about this in the book. There is a team, a workplace team in the book who has exactly this challenge. They love each other. They love the fact that their company is like has really positive energy. And whenever they do work at height. So way up in the air, kind of dangerous work. And whenever there's a safety issue, they will say whatever needs to be said. But if it's not about safety, they will skirt around the issue, right? And so one of the things that I did with this team, and this might be something that I would do with, you know, it would depend on the specific circumstance, but this would be among the possible interventions, is I have people get in pairs and stand, you know, 10 feet away from each other and have them walk right up into one another's space bubble. So we all have something called peripersonal space in the Western world that usually extends out to, like, if you just put your arms straight out from your body, that sort of draws a circle, a bubble around you. And in some cultures, that bubble's really big. In other cultures, that bubble's really small. I had them get inside each other's space bubble, right? And just look one another in the eye and say, I have something to tell you. Just that much, right? Didn't need to have any content. Just, I have something to tell you. And we did this a number of different ways. All we were doing was kind of getting in one another's space and saying something very simple. And this happened to be a workplace that was very male dominated. And one of the fellows stopped in the middle of what we were doing. And he said, oh my God, I'm so sort of activated right now. I'm sweating. I'm hot. I'm turning red. And he's like, this is exactly what I feel like when my wife says we need to talk. Right. And so one of the things that's interesting about this work and why the book had to be about everything instead of exclusively about leadership is it's just we take our bodies with us wherever we go. So all of that is to say, in a team that's having a hard time sharing important feedback with each other, what I try and help them do is anchor the feedback in what the shared purpose of the team is, right? This is what we are collectively trying to do together. And this way that you're showing up is either not contributing or it's hampering, right? And there's, again, if we're coming back to sort of tips and tricks, there's some specific phrasing that you can use, right? Like, I wanna share with you what I'm seeing, or I have an assessment and here's how I ground that assessment. These are the specifics that I'm seeing, but all of that is underlain by this capacity to walk towards each other. And when you get there, settle your system down so that you can say the hard thing from the part of you that is kind of wise, intelligent, together, right? You can say it without aggression, but also without timidity. You can say it with clarity, not confusion. And it takes practice. So I hope I illustrated that clearly.
I think you did. And you also closed with some beautiful alliteration, which is just the, you know, cherry on top. JP, I think we're going to need a part two, if Amanda's willing, but there's so much still to unpack. And maybe that's just me needing to read the book and dive deeper into your work. But this has been such an incredible learning opportunity. So if nothing else, just thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a fun conversation and I really appreciate you guys having me. Thank you. Part two sounds fun.
All right, that's it for our conversation with Amanda Blake. This work is so important. If there's one area that I'm looking to do more and more work as a coach of leaders, this is it. The hard part is this kind of somatic work. It's different. You know, for instance, when I ask leaders to check in on what they're feeling in their body, I sometimes get these looks like, what are you talking about? Why are you asking about, you know, what I feel in my body? It's just so foreign to us. But without a doubt, our disconnect as humans with each other due to technology, our disconnect to nature, and our disconnect from our bodies, it's hurting us. It's holding us back. It's leading to so much of the mental health challenges that we're facing as a society. And so this is important and valuable work. So be sure to check out Amanda Blake at mbright.org and her book, Your Body is Your Brain. If you have any questions for me, please shoot me an email at jpnerbun@tocculture.com or reach out through my website at tocculture.com. Thanks for listening in. Be sure to hit the subscribe button on this podcast so you don't miss our next episode on accountability within your team. When you get a chance, please leave us a review. We have thousands of listeners each week, and yet we only have a few hundred reviews. We need you as a listener to take 30 seconds to leave us a review. It helps us to continue to make this podcast possible.